A qualified good morning. Thank you for coming in and being on time.
Oops. That's what happens.
The court calls United States v. Olson. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Judge Baker, members of the Honorable Court, Captain Jeff Davis, along with Captain Shane Morgan, who represent the appellant, Herman Olson.
Can you hear in the back? They can't hear in the back. Can you play around with the microphone or else turn around and talk to them instead of us?
I'll speak up, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah. The military judge committed legal error in this case when he found that Herman Olson's consent was voluntary because at least four of the six Wallace factors weighed in her favor. That was a restriction on her liberty, coercive tactics and undue influence used by OSI, the fact that she did not consult counsel, and that there was a prior rights violation. I would like to start with the prior rights violation because that's where the military judge's ruling is the most factual and legally inconsistent. On the record, he finds on multiple occasions that OSI violated Aaron Olson's Article 31 rights. He says that at least no later than the point of the smoke break, he objectively found that OSI should have suspected her of some offense, even if it's just an accomplice, and should have advised her of her Article 31 rights, and they didn't do so. This was prior to her giving consent. Nonetheless, he then turns around and says there's no prior rights violation, even though he finds her.
But Article 31 rights go to a testimonial statement and don't go toward consent for a search. So even assuming if he was right, how does that translate into our analysis for the voluntary search?
Under the Wallace factors, as I understand it, Your Honor, what this court has held is if there's a prior rights violation to include Article 31 rights, did that violation have a coercive effect on the consent being given? In this case, I would argue that there was. And where I would start at with that is the testimony of Special Agent Birch. Now, Special Agent Birch, according to his testimony, was really not involved in this investigation, didn't know anything about it, and really didn't even know Aaron Olson was there. What happens is Aaron Olson, when she's confronted with the consent to search form, she says, "No, before I tell him this, I would like to take some time to think about it, and I'd like to talk to my husband and take a smoke break." So instead of allowing her to do that, the agents go find Agent Birch because he's a smoker. And they specifically ask him, according to his testimony, we want you to go take a smoke break with Airman Olson so you can help her to consent to sign the search form. And so he does that. And in his testimony, Special Agent Birch says, this is on direct examination by trial counsel, so you told the accused that she had nothing to worry about. Answer correct. Okay, and you told her under absolutely no circumstances that she had anything to worry about with this search. Answer, correct. Did you qualify that at all? Answer, no. And the trial counsel realized this is a bit of a problem and finally gets Agent Birch to say, well, what I told her was as long as she didn't do anything wrong. Now, what this brings me back to is, now during cross-examination, and this ties into Article 31 rights and why I think it's a coercive effect on the process. He's asked on cross-examination, now you said Airman Olson understood the form, the consent form that she filled out, is that right? Answer, yes. And I'm on page 141 of the joint appendix. Did she ask any questions about the form? Answer, no. Question, she didn't ask why you said it with respect to Article 12 was on there, the violation, Article 112. Actually, I think she did ask about that. So she asked some questions about the form, correct? Yes. And you told her she didn't have anything to worry about. Answer, correct. So as this is unfolding in front of Airman Olson, she's consistently being told that she has nothing to worry about, that she's not under investigation, investigating her husband, and that she's just signed the consent form. So the coercive effect of not reading her rights changes the entire dynamic of the atmosphere in the room. She has no idea, unlike the accused in Wallace, for example, who did have his rights read to him and sort of knew he was the accused and knew he was under investigation, that's what changes the dynamic. When you read them the rights, or let me phrase it this way, with OSI refusing to read the rights, it kind of draws the sting out of the whole interrogation, and it puts the person at ease. It's effectively a tactic. It's not twisting an arm, but it's a manipulation.
What are we testing for? Are we testing to see if the statement was coerced or whether the statement was voluntary, and are they one and the same?
Your Honor, I don't think you're testing regarding a statement at all.
I'm not the statement, I'm sorry, the consent to search. I'm somewhere else.
My understanding of the law from reading Wallace and the recent case of Pierbin, and I may be mispronouncing that case, is the test is, did the rights violation have a coercive effect on getting this person to consent? I think a better way of phrasing it, and the way it was phrased by this court in Wallace.
Is that the particular factor, or are you saying that's what we're looking for overall? What are we overall testing for? Whether there was coercion or whether there was consent, a voluntary consent.
Well, the overall test is, under all the facts and circumstances, was Aaron Olson's consent voluntarily given? That's the ultimate question for the court.
It doesn't seem like there was any coercion here. It seems like there was trickery.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. I would just disagree that coercion doesn't include trickery. If I would go back to, I'll start first with a longer statement. The Wallace factors come from the Air Force Court Murphy. Sometimes the Wallace factors are referred to as the Murphy factors. And so when Murphy laid out the factors, and Chief Judge Baker, I think in your concurring opinion, you actually flushed them out completely as they did in Murphy. And so it says, the presence of any coercion, promises, direct orders, threats, including threats to consent to search withheld, or other forms of intimidation or pressure. So in this case, and we'll get there, but I'll try to answer the question more direct, there was, according to Aaron Nelson, a threat to get a search warrant. She didn't sign a consent form. But this notion of voluntary consent that we're talking about, and these Wallace factors and Murphy factors, with all due respect, wasn't created by this court, and the requirement wasn't created by this court. It was created by the Supreme Court. And we can go back to Bustamante for that. And Bustamante repeatedly makes clear that they're not just talking about physical arm twisting as the only thing that can count as coercion. Bustamante specifically talks about on numerous occasions this idea of covert force, implicit force, or what they also call as subtle force. And they're saying it's just as offensive when law enforcement uses these subtle tactics to try to get someone to consent, just as if they arm twist.
Let me ask a different question. And for the sake of illustration, engage in the absurd. You're testing for coercion. What if they said, we would like to conduct a health inspection of your home for the safety of your children? And otherwise, the record reflected that they provided lobsters and fanned the person and sang nice songs to her the whole time. So there's no issue, possible suggestion of coercion. The only thing that was different was they said, we want to conduct a health inspection. Is that a voluntary consent?
I don't mean to be difficult, but I would say maybe yes, but the reason or what makes it different is what it appears OSI is up to in doing this. That's what I think is the key factor. I guess if OSI is randomly putting people's names in a fishbowl and pulling them out once a month to do a random health and safety inspection, and they do it by
now,
just
let's take
exactly
this case. We'll stipulate that there's absolutely no indication of coercion. The individual says, oh, I knew I could leave at any time. I couldn't have been happier sitting in the conference room. The only thing I didn't understand was they told me they were going to do a health inspection, so I consented, and it turned out it was a search.
I think under the facts you're explaining to me, based on the Supreme Court, Wallace and Murphy, I would say no.
No what?
No, that it wasn't coerced.
But so yep, that's so a voluntary consent? Is that voluntary consent?
I mean, I probably still argue it's not voluntary because it's consenting to what?
Well, if they're flat out lying, if there's no overt coercion, but they're just flat out lying.
Then I think under the law.
Because that's a follow up to the Chief Judge's question.
That's if they're what just I'm trying to get
flat out lying, but there's no formal or physical or what have you coercion, then what would you say?
I think a flat out lie is coercion. I do.
Okay. Has the effect of coercion under Schneckel.
Yes, because okay. It's trickery. And in this case, it went even further because there was continued promises over and over again to Airman Olson that she had nothing to worry about. And it's those promises and those lies that changed the entire dynamic for the whole reason that we wanted to be voluntary. That this person made a conscious decision to consent to the search. Well, Airman Olson really didn't. She's being told by OSI, we want to search your house for safety. And the judge just says that seems absurd to him, but yet he sort of does nothing with it.
Okay, now if you could look at this record and this judge's findings and indicate why this is like that hypothetical or why this is not like that hypothetical.
Because I think it's the background facts that...
But you have to use the military judge's findings.
Yes, Ron. I mean, what I would start with is findings of fact. Well, arguably, it's probably a conclusion of law, but starting with this conclusion of law that OSI either did in fact or reasonably should have suspected her of offense and should have read her rights prior to asking for consent. And that's, I think, one of the key differences here. It's almost trickery from the beginning. She's not even told she's going to OSI. She's told to go to the education building and ask for Agent Carter and to pick up the phone and call. And then when she's brought in, it's, oh, everybody's on a first name basis here. We're not investigating you. We're investigating your husband. You have nothing to worry about. This is no big deal. Just sign the consent form. And then at that critical stage, and I want to go back to the exact phrasing this court used in Wallace and its opinion. And this is where I think the line is as to kind of what you have to prove is the test is whether the appellant's inclination to refuse was stifled by OSI. So we have in this case an inclination on the part of Airman Olson to not consent. She says, at the very moment she's asked to sign, I want to break. I want to think about it. I'm inclined not to consent. And then OSI engaged in...
She was inclined not to consent or she was inclined to smoke?
No, the smoke break was being asked, hey, if I'm going to go take a break to talk about this and some of the smoke that I want to smoke too. She specifically didn't say at the point of being consent, I want to go smoke. She said, I want to think about it. And while I'm thinking about it, I also like to take a smoke break because I'm a smoker. So we have her expressing an inclination not to consent, and then we have OSI stifling it because, again, and this is Agent Birch's own testimony, he wasn't just randomly asked, would you go smoke with this person and escort her? He was asked, we are trying to get her to consent. Will you go talk to her and try to get her to consent? That's his own testimony in the record.
Consul, when you started your argument, you said that four of the Wallace factors favored your position.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you've been arguing quite a bit about the failure to give the Article 31 rights, but in fact, it seems to me that you use the failure to give the Article 31 rights to support your argument that it was a coercive environment, that she wasn't able to consult counsel, and a prior rights investigation. Had they given the Article 31 rights, would we be here today?
I think it would change the dynamics dramatically. Because then you couldn't argue that Airman Olson didn't have any idea what was going on here and she was being tricked.
Well, let me repeat the question. Had they given the Article 31 rights, would we be here?
Here's my only problem, I guess, with trying to answer the question. If they had done it at that point, while Agent Birch is out, and I guess it becomes a question of time. And the reason I'm having difficulty with the question, Your Honor, is Agent Birch is repeatedly telling her, you have nothing to worry about. And he's telling her this during the smoke break. So I guess they can't have it both ways. They can't read her rights and tell her she has nothing to worry about. So at some point, OSI's got to make a definitive sort of statement to her, okay, we might have thought we were investigating your husband, but at this point, we've gathered enough information that we've changed course. It's not an investigation against you. We need to read you your rights. I suppose it's...
Essentially, what you're arguing, it seems to me, is that the failure to give the Article 31 rights goes back to the fact that they really did suspect her of a crime and that they were lying to her, as we had one of the hypotheticals earlier.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's a large part of the case.
Did the military judge find that?
No. He didn't find that he thought the whole entire thing was a ruse from the get-go.
And didn't he specifically say that he didn't think that they engaged in a subterfuge?
Yes, Your Honor. He did specifically say that he did not think the whole thing was a subterfuge.
And how do you deal with that?
How do I deal with that, Your Honor? I mean, I'm still... I don't think we have to go that far. I think you easily can on the facts of the case, because you have to ask the question, what the heck is OSI doing? On the one hand, they're saying they're not investigating her, they're investigating her husband. But they also say they know he's a dependent, they know he lives off base, and according to Aaron Olson's testimony, the only thing he was arrested for was drug paraphernalia, which was a traffic
violation. But the military judge doesn't find that they were lying, were engaged in a subterfuge.
I agree, Your Honor, but he still finds that objectively they should have read her rights, so that still gets you to the same place. I think the argument that it's a subterfuge is stronger, but the argument that, okay, incompetence is no defense here.
What did the military judge find? Did he find that they weren't lying, or did he find that they weren't lying ab initio?
I think I would go with that one, yes.
Yeah. They may have not lied in the beginning, but he didn't find that they were perfectly honest.
No, and I think any fair reading of the judge's opinion is he, on numerous occasions, questioned the credibility of OSI. Specifically, as an example, we have the issue of Erin Olson testifying that she was told if she didn't sign the consent form that they would just go get a search warrant. And that also goes back to the element of coercion, because that counts as a...
Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, most of the cases say that that isn't coercion, and it's a statement that they can go out and fulfill. They can go out and ask for one.
I don't disagree with that, but I don't agree entirely. I agree with
you. Do you have a case that supports that position?
Well, yes. What I would argue, Your Honor, is I agree that every case has said that one issue isn't conclusively made. OSI can do that. That in and of itself doesn't make the consent non-voluntary. But what Wallace says is that is a factor to be determined under the heading of coercion, and that happening, that taking place, can make that factor of coercion weigh in the appellant's favor. That's specifically what this court said in Wallace and what the court said in Murphy.
If that one factor isn't coercive, how can combining it with other factors make it coercive?
Sorry, I'm not.
Well, I mean, you said you didn't have any dispute with the cases that said that that one factor by itself is not coercive.
No, I'm sorry, I disagree. That one factor doesn't make it involuntary. I'm not arguing, for example, since they threatened her with the search, her consent was therefore involuntary. That would be improper conclusion. But I do think you can say, since they threatened her with the search, I think that does... can lead to a conclusion that the factor of coercion is in her favor.
Counsel, out of the six. You're out of time, but Judge Olson has a question before you wrap up.
Counsel, the consent form that appellant signed refers to, quote, the nature of the offenses of which I am suspected, matter concerning which I may have knowledge, is or as follows, cites the UCMJ. In your view, to what extent, when she read that, was any subterfuge vitiated?
Again, Your Honor, I would go back to the testimony that I think I referenced earlier, because Agent Birch testified very specifically about that form. And so, according to Agent Birch, Erin Olson did have questions about that. She was confused, it appears, because on the one hand, she's being told you're not suspected of anything, but on the other hand, the form says Article 112A. And so Agent Birch's testimony is on Joint Appendix 141. And so he says she asked about that, and what I told her was, you have nothing to worry about.
All right, counsel, you'll have opportunity on rebuttal to follow up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Mary Ellen Payne, and together with Mr. Roger Bruce, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge's determination that appellant voluntarily consented to the search of her home was not clearly erroneous. The military judge properly weighed the Wallace factors in finding that appellant's consent was freely and voluntarily given. This court, and indeed the Supreme Court, have repeatedly held that voluntariness of consent is a factual determination, and that the military judge's findings will not be disturbed on appeal unless unsupported by the evidence on the record or clearly erroneous.
Counsel, before you jump into that, what was OSI doing here?
Your Honor, I think that if you look at the entire record in the case, it does support the fact that OSI was focusing on appellant's husband.
Well, that's my question. He's a civilian. It's an off-base search. They are gumshoeing around off-base. There is no civilian police involvement that I can see in the record. So what are they doing here? Isn't this a flagrant violation of the Posse Comitatus Act and the policies underlying it? What are they doing here?
Your Honor, there was evidence in this case, or there was suspicion that appellant's husband was perhaps selling or distributing drugs on base, and that information came from Staff Sergeant Dahl. And indeed, the military judge in his findings of fact did find that that was a concern.
Does that allow them to go search an off-base residence?
It does, Your Honor. If a close reading.
Say they lived apart. They were married. He had an ID card. But they lived apart. She lived, you know, somewhere else. Would it be any difference then?
Well, Your Honor, I think then you might have a problem of whether or not an appellant could have consented to the search in the first place.
I think you would have a problem. But my concern here is deeper. I'm not sure that's enough of a hook to enable them to go gumshoeing around off base. Assuming arguendo that the suspicion was against him and not her, and I think that's dubious, but let's assume it arguendo.
Would that have been enough to get a search warrant? That statement from the supervisor that he thought that whether this guy had been arrested for drugs or some type of drugs, paraphernalia possession, I guess, and he's a civilian?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there would have to be a little bit more development of what exactly was fueling Sergeant Dahl's suspicion before we could say for certain whether or not there was probable cause. And that information simply is not available on the record in this case. But whether or not the agents could have, theoretically, if you consider Posse Comitatus, gone and gotten a search authorization from the local law enforcement in this case, I think if you read the cases cited by appellants in her brief, U.S. v. Chan and U.S. v. Dreyer, they support the fact that if OSI has concerns about crimes being committed on base, that they would have the ability to go off base and investigate crimes if there is that nexus that a crime is being committed on base. And certainly it seems that the allegation here was that appellant's husband was selling or distributing drugs on base.
Well, doesn't the fact that the consent form itself said that she was suspected of violating Article 112A indicate that they thought that she was the one they were investigating?
Necessarily, Your Honor, because the wording of the form says either that she's suspected of or that she may have had knowledge of. And certainly all the information that we have to that point is...
But 112A doesn't apply to her husband.
It does, but I think that certainly a reasonable interpretation of what was going on here is that the OSI agents don't know what else to put in this specific case. They think of things in terms of 112A. So if they're thinking about what they're going to put on the form, they're going to put what they know.
They should have put that they didn't suspect her of anything, which they orally kept telling her while they wrote on the form itself that they thought that she had violated this provision.
Your Honor, perhaps the best practice would have been for them to have circled crimes of which you may have knowledge, but they simply did not in that particular case. But if we are talking about the issue of whether or not appellant needed to have her Article 31 rights read to her, I think that gets a little bit away from what the real test is in the sixth Wallace factor. The real test is not only whether or not there may have been a violation of any prior rights, it's whether or not there are any coercive effects of those rights. And in this case, there simply were no coercive effects.
No coercive effects. They flat out lie to her repeatedly over an extended period to extract consent from her, and there's no coercive effect.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that they were lying to her, and certainly the military judge, that wasn't his finding of fact. His finding of fact was...
His finding of fact appears to, unless...
Can I ask an abstract question before you answer that question?
Yes, Your Honor.
And this is an abstract question to try and find out where the point of law is. If the only facts on the record were, you don't even have to take this case, but if the OSI agent said, we would like to conduct a health inspection of your home, do you voluntarily consent? And the person consents. Is that a voluntary consent to a search of the home for law enforcement purposes?
It might well not be, because certainly she's
no coercion, just trickery.
That's true, but does she know what she's voluntarily consenting to?
All I'm asking you is to answer my box. It's not a trick. I'm not going to then say, now you've conceded something else.
I think that, Your Honor, I would have concerns with OSI conducting or attempting to get consent in that way.
However, so that would not be voluntary?
I think those were the only facts. Your Honor, that indeed it's not.
How is this case distinguished from that case?
Well, I think it's distinguishable in a lot of ways. If we look at the face of the form at the bottom, it specifically told appellant that anything found during the search could be used against her. And certainly, I think that that's an important distinction there. I mean, she was on notice, and appellant admitted when she took the stand at trial, she admitted that she indeed read the form before signing it. So when she's on notice, whether or not she had been a suspect before, I mean, this could happen to anyone. You know, say you're doing a health inspection. If they're giving the form and the health inspection, on the health inspection consent form, it says, well, if you find anything illegal, you could be prosecuted for it. Then, I mean, I think that...
So her mistake was believing the agents and not relying solely on the form.
Well, Your Honor,
so don't listen to what the people say, just read the forms.
Well, Your Honor, I do think that it's important to consider that Agent Birch did say that we're not looking at you. If you've done nothing wrong, you know, you have nothing to worry about. And if we look at the military judge's findings of fact, that was his specific finding on what was said. It wasn't just, oh, we're not looking at you, you're not going to get in trouble. His specific finding was that Agent Birch said to him, if you don't have anything to worry about if you did nothing wrong. So I think certainly appellant in this case was on notice that if there were things that were...
Yeah, which way does that cut? You have nothing to worry about if you did nothing wrong. So please consent. And by the way, here's a Winston.
Well, Your Honor, there could be a lot of different reasons why appellant had concerns about not wanting OSI to search her house. And I think if you look at the entire record in this case, I think at some point it's clear that appellant's strategy becomes, well, whatever's found, I'm just going to blame it on my husband. And she sees that sort of as being an easy out in this case. I mean, we have a situation, we know Child Protective Services has a meeting with her the next day. They're going to be there. So what is she going to do with all the bombs and other drug paraphernalia that's in her house? So certainly, if you look at the entire record, we can theorize that there are some reasons why it would be advantageous for her to allow this search and then think, well, I'm just going to blame it on my husband who's not here, who hasn't been living with me for the past.
So your argument is that the search was in her benefit. That was what was in her mind. It was a good thing.
I think that there's a lot of evidence on the record that would support
And what specifically in the record supports that? Well, any testimony to that, or?
Well, Your Honor, there was testimony that there was going to be this Child Protective Services meeting that she had said that was scheduled for the following morning of the search. And there's testimony that her husband had, or at least there's a finding of fact by the military judge, that her husband had not been living with her for the past couple of months. And so what's she going to do with all these?
So you're just speculating. You're taking these excerpts from the record and speculating, well, maybe this is why she did it. There's nothing directly in the record that indicates that.
Well, Your Honor, she doesn't specifically come out and say that, but if we look at her...
So I would call that speculation.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I would agree, but sometimes in these cases, we can take the facts of the case, take the entire record, and...
Does the record reflect whether OSI knew that the husband was not living at the home at that time?
The record reflects that that came out for certain in the interview that occurred after the search, Your Honor. I know she talks extensively about that, or she does talk in detail about that in the interview that occurred.
But prior to the consent... the record does not indicate one way or the other.
It does not seem to, Your Honor. We don't know for sure what the entire breadth of what was said during the interview that occurred before the consent to search. It certainly could have been brought up.
Well, assuming again arguendo, and I agree with Judge Erdman that that's really questionable on the record, but assuming arguendo that he wasn't living there, doesn't that just undercut, make this a total subterfuge? He wasn't even living there. But we don't suspect you, lady. We suspect him. And so we're going to gumshoe off base under this civilian dwelling because we suspect him. And, oh, dear, what do we find here? It sounds like a total subterfuge. It sounds like a lie from the get-go. And where does that leave us?
Well, I think, again, Your Honor, it's important to look at the military judge's finding of fact and consider that he had the opportunity to consider the credibility of the witnesses in this case, to listen to the testimony of all three OSI agents. And after that, and also of appellant herself, he had the opportunity to evaluate her testimony and her credibility. And after doing all of that, he still concluded that there was no subterfuge in this case.
Did he conclude that, or did he conclude that there was no subterfuge ab initio?
Well, Your Honor, what I believe he said...
What was his finding of fact?
His finding of fact in the...
Or conclusion of law, again, whatever it is.
299.
Well, he says that he does not conclude that OSI necessarily believed that she was a suspect in that case. That's as far as he goes in there. And he says he concludes that they did not use subterfuge. And that was in his reconsideration after the defense had asked him to reconsider. He came back with the same ruling and again said, this time he went a little further and he says he doesn't necessarily think that they believe she was a suspect. His conclusion, of course.
But he also said they should have read her rights.
Right, Your Honor, but I think that gets into the point that he says objectively that they should have, but subjectively he doesn't believe that they actually thought that. But they should have. So perhaps, you know, his conclusion was that these were inexperienced OSI agents who should have known better, but they just did not in this particular case. But I think the important thing, Your Honor, in this case is that there were no incriminating statements made by appellant when she was originally in that conference room with OSI. She was not given Article 31 rights. She didn't say anything that would indicate that she was somehow involved. So if we're talking about coercive effects and whether or not there were any, we think about the whole concept of letting the cat out of the bag, saying something that lets out of the cat out of the bag, like in Oregon v. Elstead. And there simply wasn't anything there. There wasn't anything for OSI to take and hold over her head when they asked for consent a few minutes down the road. And so for that reason, the fact that she wasn't read her rights, really, at the end of the day, doesn't have any effect on her decision to give consent.
What about the restriction of her liberty? I mean, here she was sent over to a building that she wasn't told where she was going. She had a buzz to get into it. She's escorted into a conference room. They take her cell phone away. They later testify that that was voluntary, but they didn't tell her it was voluntary, and they didn't tell her that she could ask to have it back. She asked to go to her car to get a cigarette, and they won't let her. She asked to go out and have a cigarette break, and they send an escort with her. Doesn't that indicate that there was some restriction on her freedom?
Well, I would agree with the military judge here, Your Honor, that these were merely nominal restrictions. And when we look at whether or not someone's liberty was restricted, it's an objective test. It's what a reasonable person would think. And I think we have to start at the very beginning and look at the fact that she was not escorted over to OSI.
She was told to go over to OSI by her superior.
Well, by a
staff. She's in the military. Well,
yes, Your Honor, but it was a staff sergeant, so it doesn't really have the same effect as if it was her first sergeant escorting her over there. Furthermore...
So you can pay less attention to a directive from a staff sergeant than a first sergeant?
I certainly think if she had not wanted to go, or if she had some issues, she said, oh, I feel sick today, she might, I have to finish this up, she would be more comfortable communicating that to a staff sergeant rather than to her first
sergeant. So if a captain would have told her to go over, it would have made a difference?
It quite possibly could have, Your Honor, but I think...
Was there any indication? So she went over by herself?
Yes, sir.
And how did she get... Did she go to her house when the search was conducted?
She did go to her house, Your Honor, and she drove by herself. She was not escorted, which I think is a very important distinction if we look at Wallace.
Is there any indication that she was told she couldn't have her phone back?
No, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, the agents testified that if she had asked for her phone back, she would have been given it back. And there's no indication on the record whatsoever that she asked to have her phone back.
And physically, where did the discussion take place?
The discussion took place in a conference room rather than an interrogation room. It had windows, it was lighted, it was at a conference table. She sat closest to the door. The door was not locked. The agents were on the other side of the conference table from her. So this is a very different situation from when someone is brought into OSI to be interrogated in one of their interrogation rooms. It provides a stark contrast, even if you look at the video later in the evening when she's actually brought in and read her rights after the search is conducted.
Does it matter one way or the other whether there was subterfuge? We've been talking about that, and the question is, so what? Don't law enforcement folks, as the appellant indicated herself, engage in such tactics?
Your Honor, subterfuge is quite often a permissible law enforcement tactic. Now, in the entire totality of the circumstances, it could potentially be something that weighed in appellant's favor, but if you look at the totality of the circumstances in this particular case, even if there was subterfuge, the rest of the evidence indicates that this was not an intimidating environment. Very importantly, appellant was notified, she read the entire form, and it notified her that she had the right to refuse consent. I mean, it was very plainly printed on the form. The form that she signed furthermore indicated that her decision was her own free will and she had not been coerced. So when you look at the totality of the circumstances, it's a very, very high hurdle to overcome the fact that she signed a form that indicated that there was no coercion.
Your response is it does not matter one way or the other if there was subterfuge.
Yes, Your Honor. In the totality of circumstances in this case, it absolutely does not matter.
Counsel, the military judge appears to have made, on two different occasions, I'm at 291, maybe in a day 291 and 292, there's references to her having a family in law enforcement or some other capacity and understood that they would ask questions in a manner designed to convince her to provide consent. That's on 291 and on 292 when he's talking about whether she was or was not told that if she didn't consent that they could get a warrant. He said that the accused may have inferred to deduce that based on just her general knowledge. How do those two factors weigh into the voluntariness analysis?
And, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. May I answer?
You may.
Your Honor, I think that it weighs in favor of the government that she has this law enforcement knowledge. She says she knows about tactics, and so certainly she's going to be aware of that, and she's going to be able to weigh those consequences, those potential consequences, when she makes her decision. And indeed, the record shows that she was given time. She was given time to go and think about things, and she actually did weigh them through her mind. She talked about these issues with Agent Birch while she was on her smoke break. And so clearly, she's thinking about this, and she's taking it into consideration. And so that points in favor of voluntariness in this particular case.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you have the opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding the cell phone, it's correct that when it was taken, she wasn't told that she could ask for it back. In fact, according to Agent Carter, it appears that she never got it back. But what's crucial about the phone, where I think it plays in the most significance, while she's out at the smoke break with Agent Birch, she specifically tells Agent Birch she wants to call her husband to talk to him about this, whether she should consent. And Agent Birch's own testimony is he dissuaded her from doing that. He didn't say, well, look, you handing over your cell phone was voluntary, you didn't have it back and call your husband. No, they continue the thing, the oversized theme, no, you shouldn't call your husband, this doesn't have anything to do with you, you have nothing to worry about. And I would like to quote the Supreme Court.
Is there some case law that suggests that that's an improper tactic to dissuade people from calling someone that might talk them out of doing something?
No, I just think it's a factor in all the facts and circumstances that weighs in her favor.
And what would you have us make of her law enforcement knowledge?
I think it's minimal to end. She says her father was a corrections officer in jail, and to whatever extent that weighed in, it's completely sort of taken away by OSI continually telling her, none of that matters because you have nothing to worry about. We're not investigating you. So to whatever extent you're concerned about us investigating you, all we want to do is check your house to make sure it's safe.
Does it matter whether there was a subterfuge or not, in your view?
I think it plays a role in the court's ruling, but I don't think it's dispositive. And I guess what I would turn to, and that I would say it plays a role, is a quote from the Supreme Court, and it's the Bustamante case, but they're quoting from a prior case, which is Boyd v. United States, 116 U.S. 616. And they're quoting this case when they're talking about this idea of covert force and subtle coercion. And they say, it may be that it is an obnoxious thing in its mild and least repulsive form, but illegitimate and unconstitutional practices get their first footing in that way, namely by silent approaches and slight deviations from legal modes of procedure. And so what I read that to mean, the Supreme Court saying, is, look, this might seem a little mild, but we can't allow this to happen. This effectively, you know, U.S. v. Olson becomes a test case for investigative agencies now.
Can I ask a question, counsel, just to make sure that you agree? The standard of review is abuse of discretion, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And when we're looking at a motion to suppress, we review the evidence in the light most favorable to the party that prevailed below?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But with respect to that, what I would clarify is I stated in the briefs, and it was in the joint appendix as well, and this will be my time is running out if I make a finish this round.
Speak fast.
The judge said that he would supplement his ruling in a written ruling, and I never found it. I don't think the government did, so we're left with what's on the record. And what I would say is, the judge actually delineates findings of fact, conclusions of law. So his findings of facts run from Joint Appendix 289 to roughly 294, and then from there it's all law analysis, 294-301. And I would submit that that's all de novo review of his application of the law of facts. And that's entirely the whole entire Wallace analysis.
Any other questions up here? All right, the court will stand in. First, thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thanks, both counsel. And we're going to stand in recess until 5 past the hour. Thank you very much.